Welcome to this Climate and Local Government podcast. This is one of the ones in the section where I interview mayoral candidates in the Tasman and Nelson region. I'm Lindsay Wood from the climate strategy company Resilience Limited, and this time round I'm interviewing Tim King, who is the current mayor of Tasman and is standing again for the mayoralty in this year's elections. So I do hope that you enjoy the interview with Tim. It's quite a long podcast because although the first 20 minutes or so is spent answering the standard questions, Tim and I had quite a long discussion afterwards, if you listen to it, I do hope you find it interesting. Anyway, here goes the interview with Tim King regarding the Tasman District.
Tim, it's 4 years since the IPCC 2018 special report signalled a decarbonisation trajectory of a daunting 7.6% year-on-year from 2020 if we're to keep under a 1.5 degree C global warming. It's now 3 years since our Zero Carbon Act legislated for commensurate responses, but the subsequent lack of affection plus regional growth pretty well everywhere makes that now close to 10% reduction every year. If you're re-elected as mayor, what would be the key strategies you'd put in place to optimise your community chances of successfully decarbonising at such a formidable rate and on an ongoing basis?
Right. Well, I think that it is a massive challenge. There's no doubt about that. And the longer it takes to get started, the more difficult it's going to be to reach those goals. So I think there's two key focuses for the council. One is our own emissions profile, and that's largely driven by a couple of key factors, being landfill gas and wastewater. There's a number of other key areas, but they're the two big ones. Mm-hmm. So focusing on those is going to be crucially important. We can do a whole lot of things at the end of the life of products around flaring gas in landfills. But ultimately, like the answer to so many of these things, it's actually about reducing the amount of things that go in there. That's working with construction, particularly to reduce construction waste. That's overall food waste is another massive example of both. It has two effects. One is we produce a lot of food, it has a high emissions, and then we waste 30% of it, which is a tragedy. So that's another big area of focus. The other area that we can influence significantly is people's transport operations, the way that people travel. And so our investment in public transport, extending that out to Motueka through Mapua, Tasman, and out to Wakefield is another area that we can have a significant impact on the region's transport emissions, as well as our own individual ones. Probably the other key one is where we live. I know there's been a lot of conversation around the future development strategy, and while I know some people are disappointed that only 50% of the expected development in the next 30 years is going to be intensification or redevelopment, that's still probably at least 40% more than it's been previously. So making that happen, actually implementing it, getting it to happen as opposed to just having it in a plan is going to be very difficult. And so that will be an area that councils are going to have to focus on, how they incentivise, how they make the rule framework work for people who want to do redevelopment, and also maybe whether we have the opportunity to look at the way that land is, and we've had some discussions over the Better Off funding that's been received in relation to Three Waters, and looking at perhaps being able to aggregate up some land that then is available for redevelopment, brownfields intensification.
We're among the most energy profligate societies in history, and much of our greenhouse gas emissions comes from fossil fuels, with, as you've already said, transport emissions around 94% of individual emissions in our region. Decarbonising our energy sector is a key to decarbonising our economy, but the logistics are daunting. Electrification of almost everything, New Zealand being especially vulnerable to key global supply chain issues, and the net energy gain of all renewable energy sources, except good hydro, being inadequate to sustain our society in its present form. What do you think the energy future of the region will look like in 25 years, and what would you advocate to prepare our region to make the most of that energy future, Tim?
Yeah, again, huge question. Looking forward, I think we're fortunate to the extent that we do have some options around energy. I would certainly like to see, and again, I know another controversial subject, but the Waimea Community Dam does have the opportunity to attach hydro to it. Unfortunately, it seems difficult to get investment into that, the provision of that. So I would certainly like to see that undertaken. I know there's a number of people working on options around biofuels, particularly using wood waste from our extensive forestry sector. And so, again, I think something that needs to be continued to be invested in and looked at. I know one of the massive challenges is, and reading a lot of information from around the world, a lot of the alternatives aren't necessarily better. Wood waste and biofuel can be, but it has to be very strictly focused on wood waste. And what tends to happen is once an alternative energy source is identified, it might start off using waste, and then because if there isn't enough, someone goes, oh, well, this is a great way to make a bit of money. So we'll actually start using other wood sources, and then suddenly you go from something that's actually better to something that potentially isn't better for emissions. So again, a bit like waste management, actually reducing the amount of energy we need is going to probably be essential if we're going to reach the targets, as opposed to just looking for alternatives, as important as alternatives are going to be. So public transport is obviously a part of this as well. So our transport emissions are huge. Active transport, particularly in the larger urban areas, and there's a lot of money going to be invested in that and the walking and cycling networks over the next 10 years, supported by government funding through Waka Kotahi, because clearly they also have a focus on assisting us to meet these goals. So energy is going to be massive. I think as a region, we have the potential to both produce more of our own energy sources, but we have to be very mindful about how we're doing that and then reducing the amount of energy that we need. The way we construct houses, where we construct houses, all of those things will be key factors in ensuring that we can meet. And as you said earlier, in a growing region, it's even more challenging to meet our targets of reduction because we're kind of working against the flow of more people coming, more construction, more building, more transport.
There's a sardonic joke about sea level rise that the poor get moved and the rich get seawalls. While expert Belinda Story would suggest that might not do the wealthy much good long-term either, the real point is that disadvantaged people normally become even more disadvantaged as a result of upheaval or crisis. In a climate context, there's frequent reference to striving for a just transition, but global evidence suggests that is largely an unfulfilled aspiration. If you were re-elected as mayor, what would you like your legacy to be in the area of a just transition in climate responses, and how would you go about achieving that, please?
Yeah. Oh, that's probably the single biggest question around all of the things. So whether it's food, whether it's energy, whether it's transportation, those who have the wherewithal to be able to look and buy a Tesla, for example, or offset their travel requirements, they're always going to be able to position to, deal with these challenges more easily than those who aren't. A huge percentage of our population in this region, we're a relatively low household income economy, ironically, although that's not often seen from the outside. So we do have huge challenges, large area, small population, large travel distances. So I mean, obviously I think anyone would like their legacy to be that whatever we do, everyone is able to participate in that, both in terms of making a difference to the emissions, but also in terms of how they adapt. I'm not 100% sure how we achieve that from a council position. Reading the National Adaptation Plan that's just come out, that is one of the areas that is an area for the government to focus on. This is going to require a whole lot of people working a lot more closely together than perhaps we have in the past. Local communities are always going to struggle with making these choices and deciding about how to fund those who are unable to fund their own, whether that's protection or whether that's retreat and shifting. I think around the world, a lot of places already have much more challenging insurance environments than we do. We're getting there, and insurance is going to play a huge role in how people, or how quickly people have to start making these choices, probably even more than government policy and council policy. I know also in the adaptation plan the government's put out, they're looking at insurance, particularly around flooding, and already work's been done in a place like Westport around some protection. And that's looking to co-fund or support the investment, because I think it's been identified that these smaller communities, perhaps poorer communities, are not going to be able to fund these things themselves, or even through the funding mechanisms that we have, a council, through rates and charges, for example. So, yeah, I would like to think that my legacy would be we work collectively with a whole range of parties, including central government, including iwi, including communities, and we come up with solutions that are able to be implemented across all communities, not just those who can afford them themselves.
Yeah, you're right, it is a big issue. It's a real wicked problem.
Oh, look, I think just about all the problems we're facing in the next 3, 5, 10 years are wicked problems. There's very few of them that have simple, easy solutions. Growth, development, climate change, retreat.
Housing affordability.
Housing affordability. They go on and on. The reason they are issues and still issues are because the solutions are not obvious.
No, that's right. In reports dealing with climate-related initiatives, there are often comments such as a particular course of action not being cost-effective or not making economic sense. And yet there's almost never reference to the timeframe being considered, and almost never comparisons with the cost of not taking action, which specialists like Lord Nicholas Stern highlight are generally orders of magnitude greater. And this is often exacerbated by the imbalance of high upfront costs needed to realise longer-term benefits. Over what timescales do you think the costs and benefits of climate actions should best be evaluated? And if you were re-elected, how would you reconcile the often unresolved conflict of prioritising funds now for benefits over a much longer term?
Right. The costs, I think we're very good at identifying costs. We're not so good at identifying value. And I think that's the challenge. And it's not just in the climate space. So that's an infrastructure investment generally. And we've got a good example locally, and we're going to face more of these challenges in the future. The Waimea Dam project, in the initial 10 years of conversation, most people were supportive of the concept of storing water for the long term, looking at something intergenerational that was going to address issues for 100 years plus. The challenge became particularly acute when you have to work out who's going to pay for that today. And that is the case with pretty much all of these major investments in infrastructure generally, but in climate infrastructure particularly. So my personal view is, and the reason I was a supporter of the dam project, and I am a supporter of the investment in infrastructure generally, is that we need to look that 50-100 year time horizon. The Te Tau Ihu intergenerational strategy, which has the tagline of being a good ancestor, I think is the way that we have to look at most of these investments that we're being asked to make, whether it's as a council, a community, or the government, because it's very easy. And what we've done for 30 years is put off a lot of these big conversations and big infrastructure investments. We're still living on investments from generations ago, and we're going to have to bite the bullet and invest significantly, not just in infrastructure, but in all sorts of solutions. So whether that's planting initiatives that have a long-term time horizon, whether that's looking at the way that we deal with waste, whether it's putting the cost of things up front as opposed to at the end, and the stewardship programs that central government's been, in my view, I think very slow in rolling out, to put the cost of disposal or recycling or reuse at the start when you purchase something as opposed to at the end when you dispose of it. So all of those things are going to need to be done. And the only way to look at them is to look at them on that 50, 100 year kind of time frame. It's a bit the same with the investments that we talked about earlier in terms of energy alternatives. We tend to look at, you know, people tend to look at them, then it becomes, they look at them as a, as an emissions off improvement, then they become a business opportunity. And then quite often what you find, and a classic example is wood pellets and biofuel in Europe, most of which comes from the southern states of America, the wood. And then it's shipped and transported. And because the way, and so much of this is about accounting, it appears. And so you read the government reports from around the world and how well they're doing, and then you read NGO reports, which actually go, well, yeah, accounting-wise, it looks quite good, but in actual impact, it might not be nearly as good as it looks. And I think that's another huge challenge. So for me, it's identifying value as opposed to just cost, and it is looking at that 100-year time frame in terms of what we get back as a return in the wider sense, not a financial return, but a return across all the measures that we have to look at.
Yeah, that's another good answer, Tim. Thank you for that. Just out of interest, about a year or two ago, I did a you may or may not have ever seen the Climate Matters thing that I put out, but in it, one of the little studies that we did was with Britain's, what they call their Drax power station, which produces, you know, and if you covered the whole of the UK in trees, it still wouldn't produce enough bioenergy to meet their current energy needs. It's
I know my son worked over in the UK on a big cropping farm in Cambridgeshire, and half of their cropping was, you know, why on earth are we turning food into fuel? The world still needs food. We're turning it into fuel. So, and he also wrote a good article about the fact that just about all the energy alternatives in Europe are worse than the fossil fuels that they replace in terms of emissions.
So, that's fascinating, isn't it? Is that an article you're in a position to share with me?
Absolutely. You know, so if you Google George Man, I think it's Monbiot, in The Guardian, you'll see all his articles, and they're really interesting. They touch on a lot of
stuff. It wasn't your son that wrote the article. He referenced the George Monbiot article, did he?
I know George.
Well, I don't know him, but I know of him. And yeah, he's quite a radical thinker and a good thinker, I think.
He does have some radical ideas. But again, I think it's the key thing is that they point out a lot of the inconsistencies in the argument, in some of the solutions, which it sounds good, it looks good on paper, but the more you look into it quite often, and what it really comes back to is this fact that we can't alternative our way out of this and we can't offset our way out of it. At some point, we have to reduce the necessity for the amount of energy that we use. And how, I mean, if you think all the other problems we've discussed are challenging, that is a huge challenge.
It is, isn't it? It'll be interesting to see where we end up. I hope it's interesting and not unpleasant. Thank you.
It's hard to escape the fact that at some point it's going to be unpleasant. I mean, some of these are not going to be resolved without, as much as we talk about just transitions and we talk about alternatives and offsetting, and they are the soft end in some ways, or, you know, the easier to get public acceptance of, even if there's a cost attached to it, the actual reducing is where it becomes, I think.
Totally is. And I think, I know we're sort of wandering a little bit here, but
that's right.
It's a good discussion. I think it's important. When I've had the great, there's been a thrill interviewing all the specialists I have leading up to this series, and a consistent message that comes through, not from everybody, but from a lot of them, is that we really have to know that we can get to a good place out of this. You know, just saying we've got to stop doing this and stop doing that. And I'm as guilty as anybody of falling back on that narrative of, oh my God, we're doing too much. But unless we can paint a picture of a worthwhile end destination, it's not very motivating for people, is it?
No, I think motivation is a massive thing. I was asked the other day, actually, in terms of in relation to the climate adaptation plan and sea level rise and coastal erosion and retreat and all those options as part of the adaptation report, you know, what is my feeling? Are people alarmed? Are people concerned? And my reply was actually people were so busy, 2 years of COVID, now cost of living, that if you can't paint a positive and constructive picture, then because of all the other challenges people were facing, it just gets put in a too hard basket. It's someone else's problem, you know.
And people are
to individually influence, and therefore, people don't take action. So I think that's genuinely a big concern.
It is, and there's like a rolling maul of issues that is always going to set us back, isn't there? Whether it's COVID, whether it's the Ukraine war,
absolutely,
or the Christchurch earthquake.
The Ukraine war's impact on Europe's whole plan around energy has been so fundamental and dramatic that, and it could end up one of two ways. They could have a massive investment in green energy, or they could flick back to coal.
Yeah.
And chances are they might have to do both. They probably have to go back to coal to some degree. And then the unspoken one is obviously nuclear, which has its own challenges.
Yeah.
But at least emissions-wise, it's significantly less.
Oh, it is. And then within all of that, it touches almost on what you said before, that maybe this is their moment of truth of living with less energy, but it's a very hard way to learn it, isn't it? Better to do it by planning.
Very hard way indeed.
Well, shall I give you your magic wand now, Tim? Okay. So thank you so much for engaging with the questions I've posed. Kindly now imagine that you've been gifted a magic climate strategy wand. If your candidacy is again successful and you could conjure up any other single climate-focused council strategy you wished, please tell us what it would be and why you see it as important.
Oh, the magic wand. I guess the challenge with any magic wand is so many ways to wave it, and probably so to focus on a single one is going to be very challenging. Well, I think for this region, though, we have so much potential to, be an example. Because we have a relatively small population, we have a lot of innovation, a lot of very innovative people. A lot of that's been driven by people who've come into the region from other parts of both New Zealand and the world over the last little while. So being able to harness all of that innovation, all of that information that's come in, and put ourselves in a position to live up to our intergenerational strategy objective of being good ancestors. So that would involve a number of things, our own energy and a range of things. So the creation of hydrogen, the creation of electricity, the creation of alternative sources of using the waste from our highly innovative forestry industry to be able to continue to feed ourselves and produce food for other people. I think there's nothing more worthwhile than coming from a background of food production. Producing food in the most energy efficient way possible for both our own community and for others who are unable to produce it is something that we need to continue to be able to do. And if I had a magic wand to enable us to do that in an emission positive way, I would certainly wave that.
Right.
Where we live, if I could wave the magic wand and suddenly make everyone have a great desire to live in intensification apartments, use public transport and ride a bike, that would be useful. And I think also probably wave the magic wand in reverse and see that actually greenfields development that's well-designed, that does incorporate all the latest technology, all the best building construction, builds in public transport and active transport infrastructure isn't all bad either. So if I could wave the magic wand on one thing, and one thing only, it would be to enable these conversations to become a lot less polarized, to be able to sit down and have really constructive conversations with people with radically different views. So I think it is absolutely possible to have quite radical views and still be able to compromise and live in the middle, which is where we have to do if we're going to shift the bulk of people from where they are now to where we need to be as a community. So if there was only one thing I could do, Lindsay, with my magic wand, it would be to change that attitude from polarized to constructive, to understand that compromise isn't bad, but neither is a radical solution.
Thanks, Tim. Can I join that conversation with you? I'm totally on board with what you've just said. I think it's we all start digging trenches in our positions and then lobbing rocks at each other, don't we? And it doesn't get us very far.
No, and I think there's a lot of research says that now that, unfortunately, and why the magic wand is important, is because when you put people in a room and try and get them to listen to the other side, often they walk away with their position more entrenched.
Mm.
And quite how we get past that, I'm not sure. And it's not just in this space. I mean, all the conversations that we have, you know, whether it's biodiversity, water quality, increasingly now becoming more polarized, and that actually makes it harder to get to solutions. Frustratingly, most people's outcomes aren't that different. Where we're trying to get to is often relatively, you know, agreeable.
Yeah.
How we get there and who's paying or who's doing or who's making a contribution or who's having to, I guess, change what they do or, in inverted commas, suffer the consequences is where the divergence comes. And unfortunately, that divergence doesn't seem to be, you know, whatever the word is. I guess the conversations are just polarized.
And we tend to want to shun diversity rather than welcome it and try and find a way of fusing it together, don't we? Have you got time for me to tell you a little related story on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I had the full hour booked, Lindsay.
I'm privileged. Thank you. That's great. About 3 years ago, I was on a climate panel in the University of Humboldt in Berlin. And one of the other people on the panel had been the deputy mayor of Athens. And this exact topic cropped up. And I can't remember her name, unfortunately. And she told a story about she had a situation where it wasn't a climate story, but it was a planning one where they had developers desperate to do this and they had citizens desperate to avoid it. And they just dug their trenches. And in the end, she had a very courageous solution. She persuaded them all to join a conversation, but she started with a wall down the middle of the room built of cardboard boxes. And on one side were all the developers and planners, and on the other side were all the angry citizens. And she asked each side to have a conversation that the others could listen to over the top of the boxes. And as this went on and they heard what the other ones were saying, then she started to take the boxes down until they were all in the same room together. And she said it was just remarkable how they gained a sense of the aspirations and the problems the other side were facing, and they wound up finding a solution out of it. I thought that was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the challenge is getting people in a room. So much of what we undertake now is done remotely, so over mediums like this, whether that's social media in general, so the standard media that we see that obviously have a huge influence in how we think and what information they put out. And again, even that becomes controversial because people with different views go, well, the media, you know, the media is this view or the media is taking that view. Getting people in a room is pretty much the only solution to all of these things. And that's why I think that they're working together, that whole central government, local government, communities, iwi kind of conversations have to take place. But it's difficult to get that middle majority of people. What you tend to get in any of these conversations, so you get your government department representatives, your local council representatives, you get those kind of self-selected people with a passion for a particular approach. So they will come in. You may get a few people who are just kind of interested. But what you miss out on is that conversation with the people who are just flat out busy living their lives, raising their kids, enjoying their retirement, whatever it is. They don't engage. And that's what I find the most difficult is how you engage with that chunk of people who are ultimately going to be the solution or not to so many of these challenges, but are so flat out busy with everything else. If you could have one-on-one conversations on every one of these topics with every single person, I think you probably find you get to some lot better solutions. Unfortunately, while that's a great example out of Europe, the other example at the moment is the Dutch approach to reducing their farming impact with a 30% cut across the board. And if you look at how that's panning out and the kind of response that's happening and the polarisation that that's creating, you know, that's an example of exactly the opposite kind of. You know, they've got to a point where they believe they don't have any option. They have to make this very difficult decision, the implications of which are pretty massive. And the reaction they've got is, you know, I guess the reaction that you might expect when something like that happens.
Was it last year's agriculture and climate conference in Wellington I went to? I'm like you. I like to try and get the conversations going with other people. And when I was there, there were various people, wonderful people talking. And one was a guy called, oh, I've forgotten his name. He's an Australian specialist in climate and disaster responses. And he was saying that if we don't do the climate responses ourselves, we'll have them done to us. Which is what you're saying is happening in Holland now, isn't it? And it's very hard to get that, what can we do to ourselves? And then, of course, we get resentful when big government tells us what we've got to do. And it's treading a middle path. That's a challenge at your level too, I'm sure it is.
Yeah, it's a massive challenge. And it's difficult to find the resources to do everything that we need to do as a country of 5 million people with all the challenges that we face. And we've got some wonderful advantages living down in this part of the world. But it also comes with challenges and small population on a relatively large land area with a huge amount of natural hazards. You know, we're all subject to earthquakes, floods, small island, middle of a big ocean. So potentially we're heavily impacted already and potentially will be in the future, but even more, whether that's drought, whether that's flood, whether those fires, you know, all these things that are likely to be cyclones. We have experienced in this region, you know, all of these over the last decade or more. Not that they're new, it's just that the intensity and the frequency is likely to get worse. So, but we don't have the resources of a Europe or a UK. You know, in the UK, same land mass, roughly, you know, 15 times the population or whatever. And Europe, obviously, massive amount of resource to pour into these things that we just don't have. At the same time as trying to fund health, education, and all the other, and all the infrastructure we haven't invested in for the last 40 years. Yeah, conversations are going to be crucially important. Investment's going to be crucially important, but quite how we afford all of these things all at once. And it does appear at the moment we're trying to solve a whole lot of problems that have been 30 years in the making in 3 years.
Good point.
So I think again that probably drives people just look and go, it's too much change. You know, shouldn't we focus on just a couple of these key things that are absolutely vital to get done now and leave some of the others to work on later? And even the climate adaptation plan, you know, there's a component of that in there in terms of, and the emissions one is a bit the same. There's a lot of planning to plan. There's a lot of, we need to build strategies, and I'm not sure that's getting us where we need to be fast enough, but it is chewing up investment. And so as we're busy
and chewing up time too as well,
time and investment and structure and restructure and not so much an actual implementation. So that's something we've got to be mindful of a council as well.
Yeah,
you know, we have limited resources. The balance between emissions reduction and adaptation is important, and crucially, it's how much you put into actual action as opposed to strategizing.
Hey, Tim, if you've got a moment, I'd like to go right off script. I'd like to put the boot on the other foot a little bit. This is me putting myself in the firing line. You very often, I think, must feel in the firing line. You have people like me or anybody saying, oh, you should be doing more of this or you shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah.
What would be a message you'd give to people like me as to how we can most, what you'd like to see from people like me who are, or climate groups or whatever, that between us all, we build up a reasonable package of expertise, but we tend to more often than not end up on the side of the people lodging objections rather than being part of the collaborative process. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. Like, I think there's a place for both. Clearly, there's a place for kind of protest. There's a place for the radical idea. There's a place for the even kind of unrealistic suggestions that are aspirational in the extreme. And there's always a place for that. In order to achieve those or work towards them, then there has to be the other side of it, which is acknowledging the challenges that those who are responsible for implementing the ideas face, and convincing the people that they then have to influence to change, and particularly around this, what we talked about, the change of behaviour, the reduction of the use of stuff, whether that's energy, whether that's materials, whether that's the amount of stuff you get from Kmart or the warehouse. These are fundamentally difficult conversations to have with communities. Mm. So it's great to have aspirational people with radical ideas, but it's important to then recognise and work with the people, and whether that's local government or central government, whether that's with industries and businesses, and understand how difficult it is. And I face all the time in farming, you know, we're inundated with Hawaka Ikanoa, water quality, massive issues, the objective of which is very difficult to debate. But when you're faced with implementing all of them at once and you're in the position of having to fund that, to work out how to do it, to just work out how many hours there are in a day to do your business as usual and all these new expectations, we don't have a heavily subsidised system as they do in Europe, where for a lot of these changes that businesses, industries, farmers and communities face, there is a huge amount of financial support. Mm. So recognising that time is critical, but it's also, this is going to take time. So I think that's my biggest plea. Continue to push out the ideas, to continue to be aspirational, but then have some empathy for the people trying to implement it, that is actually bloody difficult. So
I know at my end, and I don't think I'm a lone voice in terms of people like me who are, if you like, scouts out in the climate Netherlands a little bit, is a sense that quite often policies and things are too established before there's a sense of what the scouts are finding, where they're going ahead, if you know. I'm not trying to paint myself as some sort of angelic explorer, but somewhere it seems that we get into that, why didn't you look at this sort of thing, or there's somebody over there who knows about that. And that gap between the formulation of the draft policy and the ingredients in it, and it's a very difficult thing for you. I think also we've got two very small councils in our region, haven't we? You know, yours is a bit over 50,000 and Nelson's about the same population, totally different geography. And yet you've got to run all these bureaucratic and government processes, don't you, that must suck an awful lot of energy when it could be going maybe into other things.
Oh, look, I completely agree. And I think all the processes that are underway at the moment, all the reforms, at the moment they're diverting energy from action because the emphasis and the investment is going into those structural changes. Now, whether in the long term they're going to make things better, I don't know. I'm looking at the replacement for the RMA, the Natural and Built Environments Act, the Spatial Planning Act, and then ultimately and ironically last, the climate legislation. Mm. And what I'm seeing at the moment, I'm not sure it is going to be simpler and easier, and the processes are going to be quicker. But that is certainly the aim. Because at the moment, the planning cycle, you know, minimum 10 years to kind of get through any significant planning alterations, regardless of what that involves. Mm. So, you know, with so many of these issues we're facing, that's just not an acceptable time frame.
Yeah.
That said, how you get communities involved and give people a sense that they're having a say and having input and influence and the demand for consultation and input means that they can't be rushed either. So you are constantly caught between these two things, and hence the you know, the magic wand conversation from earlier in this discussion.
That's right.
If you had the magic wand, there would be, it's that classic, you know, you've only got three wishes, of which, you know, I guess the first wish is, can I have three more wishes?
That's right.
Because everyone would want you to wave it in a different direction on a different subject. And none of them are things, well, that's what I find all the time. Virtually none of the things that people want to try and achieve, you can dismiss as,
frivolous or anything.
Not worthwhile or frivolous. Mm,
yeah.
So whether that's in the social space, cultural space, environmental space, or financial space, when you're trying to achieve all of them at once, and quite often you find that they conflict to either a greater or lesser degree, and even some of the major government policy we're trying to implement conflicts, national policy statement on urban development with national policy statement on productive land being an interesting one.
And with the Zero Carbon Act as well, they all are fighting with each other, aren't they?
So many of them end up in conflict to a greater or lesser degree. And I think one of the challenges is amongst all this reform, doesn't appear to be a lot of joined up thinking at a national level between each of them. They're all in their kind of siloed processes. Yeah. I think the other thing is there is a lot of great stuff going on. And around our community, particularly in this region, there are so many people doing so many great things behind the scenes, whether that's in the business sense. I was reading something the other day about a zero carbon group of businesses. I can't remember them off the top of my head, but there's Hybrid Bikes and Chia Sisters, Cable Bay Adventures, Abel Tasman Canyoning. Yeah, looking at that whole tourism space, Owen River Lodge, which I think is the first carbon zero or carbon positive fishing experience in the world. So
that's great, isn't it?
There is a lot of fantastic stuff being done and worked on, which probably often gets missed as we focus on what we're not achieving or not doing fast enough. And which is why I guess I'm ultimately positive and confident that we will get there. I'm not sure we'll get there in exactly the time frame we need to. But I know we'll get there.
Mm.
I'm more worried about whether the rest of the world gets there.
Well, it's a bit like that, isn't it?
And I think that's why adaptation is so crucial, because even if we get there as a region, even if we get there as a country, we're probably still going to have to adapt to a lot of changes because I suspect lots of places are not going to get there.
Unfortunately, I think you're right. And in a way, I've always had a bit of a dream that our region could almost be a little bit of a world leader or a talisman for small communities around the world, because we're a small population. That's the advantage as well, isn't it? But to actually do that on limited resources is a challenge. Tim, I'm thoroughly enjoying this, but I also know that a busy person like you, we've still got another 10 or 12 minutes to go, but if you had 10 or 12 minutes spare, and I liberated you now, you might think, oh, that's good. I've just got a breathing space for something.
That's ideal.
So should we call it quits there and I'll let you get on?
Yep, good as gold. And feel free to use all, any, or none of what I've said.
Oh, thanks so much. That's awesome. I'm sure I will, because it's actually been a really good little chat we've had. And I really appreciate you being available for it. And also, I look forward to having another chat another time. So
yeah, good. It would be great to catch up for coffee. I'm not sure if there's you but someone sent me through something saying, be good to catch up for a coffee and just have a conversation about, particularly around that energy thing, because I think that is a
I think it is, and there's a lot of differing opinions around, or not, I wouldn't say opinions, because some of them have got strong facts in one area and some in another, and your problem, I think, is to try and do the due diligence on all the damn information that's coming across your desk, isn't it, in a way?
Yeah, there's certainly lots of people. I get stuff all the time about the latest way to, deal with this thing or that thing and zero emissions. And it also involves usually making lots of money. And the first question is also, have you done this elsewhere or is there an example? And it's like, well, no, we'd like to try. And it's like, oh, okay.
We want you to be the guinea pig.
We want you to be the guinea pig. Or, we've got a bespoke system out of China.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. So,
well, it wasn't me that invited you for a coffee. I felt privileged enough having this time with you. Hey, look, good luck in October, and thanks so much for making time for me.
Good as gold. Cheers, Lindsay. It's been good.
Good on you, Tim. Have a good day.
Sweet. See ya.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed that interview. You can find links to all of the interviews, plus the different presentation of them through Fresh FM, if you go onto the Resilience website at resilience.co.nz, and there you'll be able to link to the Climate and Councils podcasts and to the Fresh FM series and so on. So on that note, thank you very much for your company. I hope we enjoy it again for other podcasts. And this is Lindsay Word wishing you kia kaha for the climate.